You're listening to a podcast of a So French interview. This month, it is exactly a century ago that France and Britain made a secret deal. In the middle of the First World War, the two allies agreed to divide the Middle East between them. It was negotiated by the French diplomat François-Georges Picot and the British politician Sir Mark Sykes. The deal was signed on May 16, 1916 and became known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And to this day, many people consider that agreement as one of the causes of the many conflicts in the Middle East. And to talk about this forgotten episode in French and British history, we invited James Barr. He is a historian and the author of the fascinating book A Line in the Sand. And he joins us now from London by Skype. Welcome, Mr. Barr.
Hello.
Now, these two men, Sykes and Picot, who were they? To me, they seem to be quintessential British and quintessential French. Is that correct?
Sykes and Picot were about as different as you can imagine. Mark Sykes was a Conservative Member of Parliament. He'd been a Member of Parliament for about 4 years, and he was a very breezy, genial man, somebody who had a different idea every day of the week. He had discovered the Ottoman Empire as a young boy. He was taken there by his parents on holiday in the 1880s, and they went to Egypt and to Palestine, which was then under Ottoman control. And Sykes was absolutely fascinated by what he saw, and he went back to the Middle East again and again. And eventually he got a job. Before he was elected to Parliament, he got a job as an honorary attaché in the British Embassy in Constantinople, and that gave him the opportunity to keep on travelling. In 1915, this culminated with the publication of a book that he wrote called The Caliph's Last Heritage, and that was, it was part of a travel diary. François-Georges Picot was a very different man. He was much more serious. He was a rather humourless man, the British thought. And he had also served in the region. He had been France's consul to Beirut just before the First World War broke out. And in fact, the outbreak of war forced him back to Paris. He came from a family of very well-known French imperialists. And his father was Georges Picot, a very famous lawyer, writer, and biographer. In fact, he'd written a biography of Palmerston, the British Prime Minister who had decided that Britain should seize control of Egypt in 1882. And the Picot family were well known for their support of imperialism. And François-Georges Picot himself joined the French Foreign Office, the Quai d'Orsay, in 1898. And this is a really crucial part of his biography because that, of course, was the year of Fashoda, the Fashoda incident, when Britain and France nearly went to war over the ownership of the upper River Nile. And the French had sent an expedition there to try and claim that part of the world for France. And the British, when they realised what was going on, sent a counter-expedition to go and get rid of the French, get the French out, and threatened them with a war if they didn't comply. That was the year that François-Georges Picot joined France's diplomatic service. And we know it was something that really registered with him. He constantly referred to the incident. And it left him with it made him realise that in the future, France needed to be much tougher when it was dealing with the British government.
So these two men couldn't be more different. What happened when Sykes and Picot met for the very first time?
So they met for the first time in December 1915, and the circumstances of that meeting were quite awkward. Georges Picot had come to London a couple of months earlier. He'd set himself the job of negotiating an agreement with the British government over the future of the Middle East. And the early meetings he had with the British had resulted in a complete deadlock. France wanted so much, Britain wanted so much, and the two sides simply couldn't agree. And Mark Sykes then was brought in by the British cabinet to try and find a way through the impasse. And he came up with the idea of a very simple straight line division of the Middle East between France and Britain. And if you read the minutes of the meeting that Sykes went to, He described it like this. He said, "I'd like to draw a line from the E of Acre to the last K in Kirkuk." And the British minister sitting on the round the table opposite him loved this idea. I love the simplicity of it. And they frankly wanted to delegate the problem to somebody else. So they deputed Sykes to go and meet Georges Picot.
And what did François Georges Picot think of this line in the sand?
Well, it just about suited him. Georges Picot went essentially wanting to get for France what we now think of as Lebanon and Syria, and possibly Palestine as well, modern Israel. The French had long had a mixture of interests there. They had a cultural interest, strong cultural relationship, because France had set up a lot of private schools in that part of the world that were much better than the Ottoman state schools that existed. That was all part of the sort of rayonnement that the French wanted to achieve of their culture. But they also had commercial interests as well. They had bought stakes in utility companies operating in the Ottoman Empire, railways, lighting, all that sort of stuff. And they were determined to not only to protect that investment, but also to use it as a way of getting a foothold in the Eastern Mediterranean. So Georges Picot went into those negotiations wanting Syria, broadly, as he called it. And Sykes went in wanting what he called a belt of English-controlled country. Essentially, what Sykes was trying to do was protect the route to India. And so he wanted to control that part of the world between the Suez Canal eastwards to the Iranian frontier.
Was that the main idea between the division between the north and the south, this line in the sand, to secure the route from Europe to India, at the time Britain's most important colony?
That's right. The British wanted to control the route to India, exactly. And they wanted to keep away their allies, ironically. It was the assumption behind this agreement was that Britain and France and Russia would win the war. And if that happened, then France and Russia would once again be Britain's biggest rivals. And so what Britain wanted to do was create this cordon sanitaire of territory across the Middle East that meant that you had to cross British-controlled territory if you wanted to get from the Mediterranean through into the routes to India.
Now, while I was reading your book, I sometimes had the impression I was reading some kind of soap opera. France and Britain were fighting together in Europe in the First World War, but at the same time, they were backstabbing each other in the Middle East. How could you explain this paradox in the Franco-British relation?
It's something the Middle East always seems to do. It seems to manage to turn allies into rivals, I think. And that's because of its geostrategic position. The Middle East is a crossroads between three major continents, between Asia, Africa, and Europe. And because of that, the control of that part of the world has been fought over since history began. And Britain and France, although they were allies fighting the war, were always conscious that if they won the war, they would then be jostling to be the world's great superpower before the Americans arrived. Those were the stakes. And so it was quite possible to have this Janus-faced relationship. And by that I mean that on the Western Front, Britain and France were the allies, albeit often rather tense allies who disagreed over tactics and over strategy. And in the Middle East, they could be rivals. And those tensions, actually, that is partly why the Sykes-Picot agreement happened, because Britain and France had very different ideas about how to win the First World War. French wanted to launch yet another offensive on the Western Front. Because there were German troops on French soil, French public opinion insisted that the initiative had to come in France. It had to be an attempt to drive Germans out of France. But the British, of course, who were fighting in France and in Belgium, but not on their own ground, were able to think a bit more broadly, and they didn't have the same constraints that public opinion imposed. And so the British, in 1915, had come up with the idea of landing at Gallipoli. And the French regarded this as a bit of a distraction, and they were also suspicious because they knew that the British had imperial ambitions, and they thought that the British actually were putting those ambitions ahead of actually the job of winning the war. And the Sykes-Picot Agreement was designed to allay those suspicions.
Now, one of the protagonists in your book, apart from Sykes and Picot, of course, is T.E. Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia. He was very important in this period in the Middle East. What was his role exactly?
Lawrence, at the beginning of the war, was a desk officer in the intelligence branch in Cairo, and his job was plotting the movements of the various Ottoman armies using whatever information the British and the French could get hold of. But he got bored of that job, and during 1915, two of his brothers were killed fighting on the Western Front. And reading his letters from that time, you get the sense of someone who is almost embarrassed about the fact that they are not taking an active role in the war. So in 1916, when the Arab Revolt broke out, British had encouraged all along, Lawrence seized the chance to get involved in it, and particularly after it appeared to fizzle out, Lawrence went to Arabia to report on the situation and offer a solution to the problems. The thing was, though, that Lawrence was also really anti-French.
I think that's quite a euphemism, isn't it?
Exactly. And before the war, he'd worked as an archaeologist in Syria, and he didn't like the signs of French influence that he saw. Lawrence liked the Middle East as many tourists like it. They like it untouched and crumbling and redolent of all that history. And, of course, what the French were doing was bringing investment that changed things, that brought machine tools, that brought electric lighting, all those things that changed that part of the world quite dramatically from the beginning of the 20th century onwards. And Lawrence hated that. And he also didn't like the fact that it appeared to be that the French were trying to build up a position in the Eastern Mediterranean, which he thought was a threat to British-controlled Egypt. So when Lawrence went and joined the Arab Revolt and found Faisal, the man who could lead the Arabs, he also nursed this other agenda, the idea that using the Arabs, he could launch a revolt that went deep into Syria and overturn the deal that Sykes-Picot. So throughout the war, as soon as Lawrence found out about that line in the sand that Sykes and Picot had drawn that divided their two areas, Lawrence was determined that the Arabs should get north of that line into the French zone before the war was over.
So Lawrence actually wanted to make an end to the Sykes-Picot agreement.
He wanted to destroy it completely. He didn't like Sykes. He thought that Sykes was a gifted amateur who talked a very good game but didn't really know that much about what he was doing, whereas Lawrence had lived in the region. He'd worked directly with the Arabs, which is something that Sykes had never done, and he had a much better feeling for what the Arabs wanted, and he thought that Sykes had got it completely wrong.
Do you think that if Lawrence would have had his way, today's problems in the Middle East would be less serious?
That's the million-dollar question. What did Lawrence want? Lawrence, at the end of the war, proposed dividing the Middle East, not along the lines that Sykes and Picot had done, but essentially parceling it up into territories that would be ruled by the sons of Sharif Hussein, who was the man who'd launched the Arab Revolt in 1916. And there's no proof this would have been any more successful than the arrangement that Sykes and Picot came to. But it did show, the map that Lawrence came up to illustrate this plan did show that he was aware of differences in that part of the world, differences in terms of religion and in terms actually of the way that people lived, because there was a huge difference between people who lived in the cities in the Middle East and people who lived in the countryside, who were farmers or even Bedouin roaming the desert. So he appreciated there was this distinction, and he tried to resolve it that way. But ultimately, it would all depend on the quality of government in all those areas, and that's what's been so lacking ever since then.
And indeed, ever since the Sykes-Picot Agreement is seen by many as the source of all evil. Is that a cliche, or is there actually some truth to it?
The Sykes-Picot Agreement is responsible for one very important issue, and that is the Arab-Israeli conflict. Because the Sykes-Picot Agreement didn't resolve the question of Palestine. Neither of them could agree that the other one could have it. And so they resolved at the time, when they did the deal, that it should have an international administration, but neither of them liked that as a concept. No sooner had they done that deal than the British started to think of ways to undermine that outcome. And they did so by looking to the Zionists, who'd wanted a national home in Palestine since the end of the 19th century, and they'd been campaigning for that, but without much success. And the British now took up that cause, and in the Balfour Declaration in 1917, they offered the Jews a national home. And of course, that became the mandate of Palestine after the war, and a large number of Jews moved there, particularly once Hitler came to power in Germany. And that set the scene for the Arab-Israeli conflict, because that immigration of large numbers of Jews to Palestine stressed the relations between the Arabs and the Jews, and ultimately resulted in the creation of the State of Israel in 1948.
So the Israeli-Palestine conflict has its roots in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, yet the so-called Islamic State also uses Sykes-Picot in its propaganda, isn't it?
That's right. Well, they're certainly drawing on resentment, which undoubtedly exists, because in a way that Sykes-Picot means two different things. It means the deal that was done in 1960, but it also, in the Arab world, it's a shorthand for a much broader condition, which is essentially the fact that their domestic politics always subject to foreign interference, always have been, and for the foreseeable future always will be, because of the location of the Middle East, because of great power rivalry in that part of the world, and the number of interests. And so when ISIS talks about sites, borders. The borders are a symbol of this foreign interference. They are the symbol of the fact that the people living in that part of the world have not been masters of their own fate, probably ever. They have been the subjects of one or other empire, or the pawns of one or other power ever since the beginning of time.
Well, it's a century after Sykes-Picot, but you don't seem to be very optimistic about the next century, do you?
I'm not, unless those countries can develop more stable forms of government. The best antidote to these problems would be if each of these countries could produce governments that are more robust, that reflect the desires of their people, that deliver economic growth for them. And so far, all of them have failed to do that. Now, that is partly because they have been subject to foreign interference. So a country like Syria did try to hold elections in the 1940s, but those elections were consistently rigged and interfered with by foreign powers, including America, including Britain and France. Western powers were constantly trying to influence the outcome.
So only if Western powers stay out, then the Middle East may have a chance of peace?
Well, it's not just the West either, of course, because after that, the Russians moved in the 1950s and offered the Syrians, they lent them money at extremely favorable interest rates, and that cemented the relationship between Syria and Russia that you're still seeing today. So there's this constant tension. Syria finds itself as this arena for foreign rivalry ever since the Second World War, running up to today. If it could produce a more stable government, if it could deliver more economic growth for the people who live there, then I think it would have a better chance at withstanding these kinds of pressures. But for the time being, it just can't do that.
That doesn't sound very hopeful, unfortunately. Anyone who would like to understand the current crisis in the Middle East should really start reading your fascinating book, A Line in the Sand. Thank you very much, James Barr.
Thank you.
And you can find more about this topic on the author's website. That's www.jamesbarr.org.uk. Thank you for listening to this interview on So French. We regularly publish longer interviews, so if you don't want to miss any of them, just subscribe to the So French podcast in iTunes or on SoundCloud. Thank you for listening and au revoir.